Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And today we're going to do an episode we're calling Ancestral Recall, because we are very, very clever at coming up with names. This is going to be the name of our look back on Theros Beyond Death. Rather than being on top of our game and having a podcast ready as part of a set review, we're going to do a retrospective on sets. We want to look back on these previously released sets with fresh eyes. What are the cards that have made an impact in our meta and the Commander metagame as large? What live up to the hype? What problematic cards have been printed? Is there anything that we've tried brewing with, whether successfully or unsuccessfully? And are there any hidden gems that this set has uncovered, whether in the set itself or from deeper in Magic's history? Before we get to that, there's been some news lately. We are recording this on June 8th, right after Commander Fest online. And we got to play a couple of games during Commander Fest, though probably not as many as we would have liked if there had been an actual Commander Fest to go to. So I think we got to play a total of 2 games that night, which is not nearly as much as we would get in an actual Magic Fest type setting. Still quite fun. Spell table looks like it mostly held up. We had a couple of hiccups that night with lag and down rendering a video, but I was pleased to see that spell tables had some new updates. Jake, you pointed out one of those to me.
Yeah, I remember the last time you were talking about stuff that you wish spell table had. You mentioned something about the focus mode automatically changing focus to whoever the active player was, and hey, that's a thing now. So if you just go into the settings, it's a little tick box you can check, and it is functional like that.
Yeah, and that was really nice to see. They also seem to have audio working now, although for our games, we stuck with Discord for our audio just out of comfort of what we normally use. So we didn't have a chance to test that in more of a long game setting.
Yeah, I think we managed to test that it works and that we joined and could hear each other and then promptly muted it and went right back to Discord. So maybe at another point, yeah, we can give it a more thorough test to see if we can do all in one or if we should just stick with the comfortable format we've got.
Yeah, that's we do have to, you know, do our due diligence and test it out at some point. Just want to make sure that the listeners are aware. Now, since we were talking about Commander Fest earlier, we played a couple of games as part of it. Alex, you've been really testing and tweaking Winota some. How's that going?
Explosive Winota, still explosive. Now with more goblins, a bit lower to the curve. That way I can get attacks out a bit earlier. One of the changes I did make from the last time we played, though, was including the Swords of Win the Game in it, so I can try and sneak damage through and kind of get incremental value off of them. In the games that we played, I resolved the Swords both games, and they did work, but I don't feel like they, you know, warranted their slot in the deck yet. I was really excited about some of the land tech that came into it, using things like Ink Moth and Blink Moth Nexus to have creatures survive board wipes and all that, and still have something kind of recur with Winota. But certain somebody killed it, so that killed my joy. I like where it's going. There's definitely a lot more I want to do with it and kind of see where I can take it, but it's definitely going to stick around.
And Jake, you've tried a new build of Grevin.
So I realize literally the only deck I have talked about on this podcast is my Grevin deck, so I'll just keep leaning into that.
And your Coral deck.
That's true, yeah. So, I mean, it was basically just a fairly typical Grevin deck of doing lots of damage to everybody and then swinging with a Grevin. And then I started thinking, you know that card, Ancestral Recall? That's a pretty good card from what I've heard.
Oh, so I like drawing one. Paying one mana to draw 3 cards. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, so I thought maybe I could replicate that. I dug around in some of the deeper, dark recesses of old Magic cards and dug up some real stinkers that are hot garbage. But hey, they kind of work. So just 3 power creatures that cost 1 mana and have generally terrible downsides don't really matter. So some of them are like Cinderwall. It is a 3/3 defender for 1 red, and when it blocks, you have to destroy it at end of combat. There's
God, you weren't kidding about these.
There's one of my favorites is from Weatherlight, Circling Vultures. It is 1 black mana for a 3/2 flying bird, which is a pretty good rate. So of course it's got a downside. During your upkeep, you have to remove the top creature card in your graveyard from the game or sacrifice Circling Vultures. But it also, if it's in your hand, you can discard it as an instant. There, I mean, there's it doesn't do anything. You're just able to discard it at any point.
What?
I'm guessing it's in case you have a lot of vultures, you can feed them to each other. Whatever. So there's a couple other cards like that that are pretty awful, but you play them, Grevin eats them and draws you three cards for one mana. That is helpful. So I'm just trying to make the deck a little faster, a little lower to the ground, because it struggles to close out games against multiple players. So is the most speed I can give it is a nice little boost.
Yeah, that was the one issue I think you're having is not wanting to play Kingmaker during our games.
Yeah, it feels pretty bad when I'm fighting two people and have the option to kill one of them and then pretty much just lose to the crackback from the other player.
I think that brings us to our newest addition. Last week we had Scrapdos, and now we have Karlov of the Ghost Council with Loris, and hitherto yet unknown, possibly Scrap Trawler? Question mark.
No Scrap Trawler in this one. Scrap Trawler costs 3. Loris is no 3 mana permanents. This was the deck with the companion I was trying out to brew. It basically did what I wanted. I've made a couple of tweaks since the game started. I'll talk about one of the cards when we get to the hidden gem section of this episode. It's basically a Soul Sisters deck, and all the Soul Sisters cards are going to cost 1 or 2 mana. It's really easy to pump Grevin up with just a pretty bog-standard Soul Sisters package, and then just use Loris for long-term value of buying back your 1 and 2 drop creatures to trigger your Soul Sisters to get Karlov big and exile things and beat in. It did its thing reasonably well in both the games we played, so I'm pretty happy with it for now. It's going to stick around.
Awesome. And I think one of the big things about this, when you say it's based off the Soul Sisters, because of Loris's restrictions, it only says that permanents can only be 2 CMC or less. You've got a suite of spells in there that are obviously a bit more than the 2 CMC, but it only applies to permanents, so that doesn't... You've got a bit of a toolkit still available than just the 1 or 2 drops that exist, right?
Yeah, exactly. You manage to take advantage of just good cards. One of my favorites is Dusk to Dawn from Amonkhet Block. It is the weird Aftermath split cards, where the top half is basically a Wrath of God effect, 2 and 2 white for a sorcery, destroy all creatures with power 3 or greater. That basically leaves my board entirely intact, and it's primarily in there for the Aftermath side. Dawn for 3 and 2 white, a sorcery. Return all creature cards with power 2 or less from your graveyard to your hand. It's just basically a mass draw effect. Also just get to run good removal like Anguished Unmaking, that type of thing. It winds up working out sometimes. All right, that'll bring us to the start of our set retrospective, our ancestral recall. So, in the broadest terms, Theros is a enchantment-themed plane, and they brought that back for us in this set as well. The marquee cards from the set included the Theros Gods, some of whom made a comeback, which are legendary, indestructible enchantment creatures who are only creatures if you have enough devotion or colored pips on the board to their color identities in order to turn them into creatures. The big marquee mechanics for the set included Escape, which was relevantly seen on the 2 Titans from the set, and Powerhouse Enchantment, and a pivotal mechanic in Limited. We also saw the return of Constellation. This was exclusively on non-enchanted payoffs in Theros Beyond Death, whereas in the original Theros sets, Constellation was seen on enchantments as well. Important rules note for Constellation. It triggers on enter the battlefield, not cast, whereas most other Enchantress cards were looking at cast to get you your payoff. The final marquee mechanic for the set was Devotion, where effects based on Devotion scale or activate based on the number of colored pips you have in play. There were probably a smaller player overall in this set, most likely stronger in a lot of the limited environments. But for commander-wise, in addition to the gods, there was also a cycle of uncommon demigods, some of whom were kind of surprisingly relevant for commander. I'm playing in that Karlov deck that I mentioned. I have both the white and black demigods in the deck, and they do their job fairly nicely in that deck. What other takeaways do you guys have just from the set in general before we delve into individual cards and see kind of what's lived up to the hype and what hasn't?
Escape as a mechanic seemed really cool because, hey, it's like getting free cards. You get to play things twice. But it seems like a lot of the effects were either not really worth it. And also the biggest thing is that the exiling cards from your graveyard was an actual cost that I think a lot of people didn't consider when we were first evaluating cards. It gets a little tricky when you have the really large escape costs to actually be able to feed into that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Woe Strider specifically comes to mind with that one because it's such a powerful card in and of itself, being able to act as a sack outlet to scry, generating token value, and it comes back as a pretty decent beater. But when you're looking at it just either from a limited perspective or from a deck that, you know, values graveyard use, exiling four cards from your graveyard, especially if you're a bit thin on resources, is kind of a big ask. And then more so for the Titans themselves.
Any other big picture thoughts you guys had on the set before we start to get into individual cards? Alex?
I do hope, like, I've always enjoyed Constellation's effect. I mean, I enjoy as a player ETB mechanics because it makes you feel like you're kind of, you know, you're getting there. If you have components A and B in place and you cast component C, like, you get effects. So Constellation always felt good in that regards. In the long scope, though, like, I personally hope that we see more of the escape mechanic. Like, I definitely enjoyed it. It definitely, it gives another, like, a more nuanced feel to the graveyard where you can cast cards out of it without building specifically around it. The cost can still kind of be limiting, but I wouldn't mind seeing the escape mechanic again, and just to kind of see it grow and see how it can evolve.
All right, Jake, any other last big picture thoughts on the set before we move on to our next section on individual cards?
I do not have any, so let's go ahead and talk about the top 10 commanders in Theros Beyond Death as ranked by EDH Rex Data.
And I think I'll lead this one if it's okay with you guys, because it falls into a category that's both near and dear to me, enchantments and tokens, if that's all right.
Take it away.
All right, so the first card of our top 10 commanders as ranked by EDH Rex is Syona, Captain of the Pylies? And what Syona says is that when Syona, Captain Pylies, enters the battlefield, look at the top 7 cards of your library. You may reveal an aura card from among them and put it into your hand. Put the rest in the bottom of your library in a random order. As a tutor, it's strong, but what kind of makes her stick out is her second ability, whereas whenever an aura you control becomes attached to a creature, create a 1/1 white human soldier creature token. So that card is part of a 2-card combo with Shielded by Faith. Shield by Faith is another enchantment that exists, which, fun fact, you can actually tutor up with Syona. And it says enchant creature. Enchanted creature is indestructible. And whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, you may attach Shielded by Faith to it. So, you cast Syona. You cast Shielded by Faith. It creates the 1/1 token. Shielded by Faith moves to that token, triggers Syona, and you pretty much get an infinite loop of 1/1 soldier tokens. If you've got other cards in play, such as Haste Enablers, like Concordant Crossroads, things of that nature, or ETB effects where it looks at creatures entering the battlefield, you'd get an unbounded amount of those triggers.
Now, is this a deck that you'd looked at brewing with, or just one you've seen out in the wild?
I've looked at brewing it as part of the 99. Whenever I look at enchantments from a personal perspective, I either look at it as Naya or Bant. If I want to do Ores, probably end up being something Ural of the Miststalker. But she's strong in both. Like, if you're going specifically with Ores and Ural, there's a ton in there that you can get value off of just the creatures that she generates. And going with the Bant aspect, where you're trying to create, like, maybe a Pillar Forge's value, she can be an excellent finisher in and of herself.
All right. And then, Jake, I think the number 2 commander from our EDH Rack data was one that you were interested in.
So, Kroxa, Titan of Death's Hunger. It's a Rakdos commander, or rather a Rakdos legendary creature, so it can be a commander. It is one of those cards that, if you have access to infinite mana, just being able to cast it over and over will eventually win you the game. So there's a couple combos you can do with that. And in the black and red color pair, one of the more prevalent higher power combos is Wargorger Dragon Loops. So you can run through that loop. I won't go into all the details because there's info out there. And Crux himself can kill the whole table. Plus, it's just a little value card that you can sneak out every once in a while for 2 mana to force everybody to discard and potentially lose life.
So the win the game clause you were looking at with it was the enter the battlefield trigger of whenever Kruxa, Titan of Death's Hunger, enters the battlefield or attacks, each opponent discards a card. Then each opponent who didn't discard a non-land card this way loses 3 life.
Yeah, so the idea is that you cast Kruxa, everybody discards. Even if somebody has a handful of cards, if you have a sac outlet and infinite mana, you can just continue to cast Kruxa over and over. Eventually they will run out of cards in their hand, and then they'll start losing 3 life, and then they die.
Yeah, it's a little bit confusing with the wording there with the double negative, but if your opponent did not discard a non-land card, so that means if they did not discard a card that would meet that requirement, and then they're going to be losing 3 life. Interesting. So is that one you've tried brewing around or just seen being used in, you know, as a part of a shell for World Gorge or Dragon Loops?
Yeah, it's not one that I have personal experience with, but I have seen there's been a couple updates to World Gorge or Dragon decks, like the I'm blanking on her name, Zancha was around, and then it became an Anja deck, and then Kruxa is another potential head for it, and they're all very similar with very minor tweaks to them. So it's just nice to have more options.
And then number 3 on our list of top 10 commanders by EDH Direct Data, we have a card that Alex, during the pre-release, you actually had a bounty out for.
I did. The number
really
3 card is
art for it.
It's really pretty. In all fairness, I will give Theros as a set this. The constellation artwork and concept is absolutely gorgeously executed.
But why don't you tell us about it?
All right, so number 3 is Heliod, Suncrowned. And I was after Heliod, not specifically for a commander, but as part of the 99 for Rise of the Redeemed list I was looking at to kind of switch it to a +1/+1 counters theme. So kind of like Elvish Soul Sisters. It is a detriment of mine where I try to make Elves an archetype in pretty much anything. So what Heliod does to that is he's a 3 mana 5/5 with indestructible, and as long as your devotion is less than 5, it isn't a creature. The standard fare for gods. His ability is whenever you gain life, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature enchantment you control. So what I was looking forward to do is having a Soul Sisters like package in Elves with Rise, and then generate just incremental value off of creating the tokens off of Rise's ability, and then the rest of the deck doing what it wanted to do. Ultimately, it ended up leading me down a path where the deck just got too convoluted, and unfortunately didn't pan out. But it has another ability. For 1 and a white, another target creature gains lifelink until end of turn. This ability, partnered with its triggered effect, means that it is also a 2-card combo, just like Siona, with Walking Ballista. So you cast Walking Ballista for X amount is greater than 1. You give it lifelink with Heliod's ability. You sacrifice a +1/+1 counter, ping an opponent. Heliod's ability triggers, you gain a life back, put a counter on Walking Ballista, repeat the process till everyone's dead.
Now, Jake, I heard there might actually be a fringe-ish mono-white CDH deck now that's lurking around out there using Heliod as the commander.
Yeah, so there's been a couple CEDH tournaments that have run, and one of them was actually first place went to a Heliod Suncrown deck. And it's using Walking Ballista to go infinite, which, you know, it's kind of what Walking Ballista does. So all it has to do is get lifelink from Heliod and ping somebody, and that creates a trigger for Heliod to give it a +1/+1 counter, which it can remove to ping somebody, and then that
just
loop
like
goes
Alex
on.
Said, yeah, just so it's down the table.
Yeah, it's just a really efficient combo. It's what they call a 1-card combo, because the other card is your commander. And white is pretty good at tutoring up artifacts, so you can get it out fairly easily.
Yeah, I never thought I'd see a mono white deck in the CDH deck list database, but this is the world we're in now.
Hey, it's worth noting, and this would fall under, I guess, pet cards. There's a mono white Lin Sivi deck that's been out there for a while. We can't forget about the OG Rebel.
Rebels.
Yeah, technically that did also win a tournament a while ago, but yeah, it's certainly an outlier.
Well, the number 4 card on our list of the top 10 EDH red cards is a card that I tried brewing around with Uro, Titan of Nature's Wrath, multi-format all-star for one green and a blue, a 6/6 legendary Elder Giant. When enters the battlefield, sacrifice unless it escapes, just like Kroxa, the other Titan. And whenever Uro enters the battlefield or attacks, you gain 3 life and draw a card. Then you may put a land card from your hand onto the battlefield. And the escape cost is 2 green, 2 blue, exile 5 other cards from your graveyard. Absolute house in multiple formats. It is seeing play in Standard. It is seeing play in Pioneer. It is seeing play in Modern. Having a reusable value engine, turns out, is good. I tried to build a Uro deck with Uro at the helm. Tried to have it have a little bit of a Staxy sub-theme with returning lands to hand and trying to outvalue people that way with Uro's triggers. I've seen a couple of other content creators trying to build optimized lists with Uro doing similar things, others just trying to lean on him as a value engine. It wound up not working out the way that I was really hoping for with the deck. The fact that it's this popular means it certainly has some kind of legs. I have not really run into the wild, and I would honestly call my experiment with the deck a failure. Alex, you got to see the deck firsthand. Part of the issue I felt with the deck was your, at the time, Yarok deck was doing something similar, but much better.
So Yarok's inherent ability of pretty much just making it a Panharmonicon was just, it was mimicking a lot of what you're wanting to do with Uro. It looked like at the time Yarok was just doing it faster. So if given the time with no interaction, Uro I think definitely would have got there. But those are magical Christmas land kind of EDH games where you're not interacting with. That being said, playing Uro in the 99 of Yarok would have been really interesting.
Yeah, that might be where he winds up, somewhere like that. Now, we got a couple of other commanders on our list who I have personally seen one of in the wild so far. Number 5 on our list is Clothis, God of Destiny, who has replaced Xenagos as the new cruel god on Theros.
How does that make you feel, Jake?
Well, I personally replaced Xenagos with Grevin as my smashy smash deck, so I can kind of get behind Clothis there.
So Clothis is one green and a red for a legendary enchantment creature, God with Indestructible. It is a 4/5. As long as your devotion to red and green is less than 7, Clothis is a creature. And then Clothis's unique ability is at the beginning of your pre-combat main phase, exile target card from the graveyard. If it was a land card, add red or green. Otherwise, you gain 2 life and Clothis deals 2 damage to each opponent. The decks where I've seen it be played, it's just kind of as a value commander to get you ahead by 1 mana each turn. And occasionally just hit each opponent. It hasn't seemed that impressive from the command zone. I'm kind of surprised to see it this high up on the list of commanders, but people like their indestructible enchantment gods. They like when their commander sticks around forever, so I guess that kind of makes sense.
It has some relevant interaction with graveyards as well that traditionally Gruul doesn't have access to.
That's fair. Then our next commander on the list, number 6, is Purphoros Bronze Blooded. And this is the sneak attack Purphoros who can put a red creature or artifact creature from your hand onto the battlefield.
So it's weird. You think about Purphoros and you think, oh, it's got sneak attack printed on it. And, you know, when I was first getting into Magic and I was, you know, learning about Legacy and things of that nature, Sneak and Show was like, you know, the deck to beat. This was a while back. So you look at a commander that's indestructible, that has the ability, pay 2 mana, and pretty much sneak attack something, you know, it just screams that, hey, you can do powerful things with this. And at the same time, it has very large shoes to fill from its original counterpart from the original Theros block, where that Purphoros was simply, whenever a creature enters the battlefield, to everybody.
It feels like they're trying to do very different things, which I was kind of pleased to see overall, that new Purphoros is trying to be very distinct from old Purphoros. Sneak attack in the command show zone is really nice. Sneak and show is really powerful, and obviously there are some really powerful red creatures and artifact creatures you can drop with it. But at the same time, we also kind of just got that out of Ilharg the Razor. So I guess it felt just a little bit less unique to me. But again, people like their indestructible, uninteractable god commanders to stick around forever. So yeah, I get it. Number 7 on our list is Thassa Deep Dwelling. And she's also changed a little bit from her original incarnation. She is now 3 and a blue for a legendary enchantment creature god, 6/5 indestructible. If your devotion to blue is less than 5, she's not a creature. Her unique ability is at the beginning of your end step, exile up to 1 other target creature you control, then return that card to the battlefield under your control. She also has an activated ability for 3 and a blue, tap another target creature. I currently have her running in my Esper Blink deck under the care of Aminatu, the Fate Shifter. Relevantly, she has her ability come and have an effect on the turn you cast her. So by your end step, you will be blinking something, getting some kind of value off of her. End to the battlefield effects are good, and being able to reuse them in most, you know, balanced games of Commander is a good thing. Also relevantly, note that it is a creature you control, and then it comes back into play under your control. You do not have to own the card that you are flickering. It does not come back into play under its owner's control. This was a similar wording we saw in the Innistrad block. So it does let you essentially flicker and then keep a card you have threatened. Threatened being a temporary steal effect. It also lets you keep the card if you had an effect like Control Magic on it.
Yeah, when I first saw her, I wasn't thinking too much about it. And then in my time playing Brawl to get my, you know, magic fix before we found Spell Table, facing down Thassa with an Agent of Treachery started being a lot of just not fun. And there could be some fun there between like Purphoros and Thassa being on the board together. You sneak something out, stack the trigger so Thassa blinks it. It could be cool.
I think one reason why Thassa's on this list, along with Clothis, is just the fact that they're very sticky engines for your decks. They may not have like super flashy effects, but they're things that you can get out pretty early, and they are repeatable engines. People love to blink things, so having an indestructible blinking effect every turn is just, you know, helpful for those decks.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I can think of a specific Team or Steal Your Things deck that would appreciate Thassa.
And then speaking of more sticky, indestructible gods, we have the new version of Athreos, Athreos the Shroud Veil. And Athreos is 4 a white and a black for a legendary enchantment creature god. It is a 4/7 indestructible. As long as your devotion to white and black is less than 7, Athreos isn't a creature. At the beginning of your end step, put a coin counter on another target creature. What does a coin counter do, you might ask? Well, whenever a creature with a coin counter on it dies or is put in exile, return that card to the battlefield under your control. This one seems like it's gotten a lot of popularity with the box topper for the buy a box, excuse me, it was the buy a box promo for Theros Beyond Death. So quite a few of those out there. Again, it is an indestructible god. I kind of compare it to a slow or weaker version of cards like Debtor's Knell that just steal other people's creatures on the way to the graveyard. The advantage to it being that, again, Jake, like you said, it's in the command zone. It's something they can use. And something you can rely on to stick around and rely on getting out. I had brewed a little bit around this one as essentially just removal tribal, where if you're in Orzhov colors, black and white, you have some of the best removal in the game. So why not also just turn all that removal into steal your stuff? Why not have a path to exile also be, and then give me that consecrated sphinx that I just killed? It has still not really come together yet. It's not really gone much farther than the brewing stages, but that's because decks like Karlov have come around that have taken my attention and my stockpile of Orzhov cards for the deck. And then, Alex, I think the next card on the list was one that you had thought about a little bit.
Definitely. So the third card on our list is, or the ninth card on our list, but also kind of segues into a bit later on, is Dalakos, Crafter of Wonders. He's 3 mana, a generic, a blue and a red, for a legendary creature, Merfolk Artificer. And he has ability, tap, add 2 colorless mana, spend this mana only to cast artifact spells or activate abilities of artifacts. Equip creatures you control have flying and haste, and he's a 2/4. Now, I have a history of trying to play Voltron artifact decks within our meta. It started with a Miri, Weatherlight Captain, I believe. And then it went from Miri to Weatherlight Duelist. So it started with Miri, Weatherlight Duelist. And then it went to Akiria Lineslinger. And then it went to the Knight.
Balin, Wandering Knight.
No, not Balin. The one from Throne of Eldraine, the Mardu colored one.
Sir Gwyn.
I went to Sir Gwyn trying to be Knight Artifact or Knight Voltron Artifact Tribal. And then in that vein, I was like, all right, so let's do Merfolk Voltron Tribal and see how that works. And I had a list drawn up and I never assembled it. I don't know. Maybe it just didn't appeal to me. I just was trying to figure out why I was doing this. And realistically, the lack of white really hurts. Like, it really hurts. Sigarda's Aid and Sigarda's Aid effects are just too strong to pass up.
Seems fair. Now, the last commander, number 10 on the top 10 commanders by EDH Rec Data, is Atriss, Oracle of Half-Truths, which is a Dimir commander. So it is 2 of blue and a black for a legendary human advisor, 3/2 with menace. When this card enters the battlefield, target opponent looks at the top 3 cards of your library and separates them into a face-down pile and a face-up pile. Put one pile up into your hand and the other into your graveyard. So it is essentially a factor fiction in your command zone in Dimir. I can see the appeal of it. It sounds like it would be a lot of fun. I'm not sure how powerful it would be. Again, I have it in my Esper Blink deck because it has a reanimator theme to it as well. And I don't mind if big, dumb creatures wind up in my graveyard. That's actually where I want them to be. I haven't seen one of these in the wild yet. I'm a little surprised that it's this high on the list, but at the same time, it does seem like kind of that fun, casual deck of very interactive with other members of your table, getting to see cards from your deck and play this mini game with each other. Now, that brings us to the end of the top 10 commanders from the set. There was one other commander or legendary creature from the set that I was trying to brew around a little bit, and that would actually be one of the demigods, the blue demigod, which is Caliphae, beloved of the sea. Caliphae is 1/2 blue for a legendary enchantment creature demigod. It is a star 3 where her power is equal to your devotion to blue. Creatures and enchantments you control have spells your opponents cast that target this permanent cost 1 generic mana more to cast. I mostly looked at her as trying to fill out my set of monocolored commanders without being the classic mono blue deck that everyone kind of hates at more balanced tables of all the counter spells. It is a unique effect. It is potentially a Voltron type commander. I don't think I got much past maybe the top 30 cards going into the deck before I wound up having my interest taken in other directions. She's still probably my number one or number two choice for the just kind of relaxed, semi-casual, balanced-esque mono blue commander. I'm going to revisit it at some point, I promise. I was looking primarily at other enchantments that had a lot of blue mana pips in them and realized that things like Mind Over Matter, number one, I probably didn't have a lot to do with the massive advantage those provided, but also number two would paint a giant target on my head, as always happens when someone casts Mind Over.
It's funny you mentioned being that traditional blue player at the table with all the counter spells. You said traditional mono blue, my mind went immediately to artifacts.
Yeah, that's also certainly a possibility, but this one seems like it would be the one that would want more pips, and I already have lots of decks that play around with lots of artifacts, so I think I can leave that one for later. So the next part we're going to talk about are the most hyped cards that may not have lived up to their expectations. During preview season, we often get very excited about brand new cards with really flashy effects or exciting seeming abilities or even ones that just have really powerful names. In no particular order, we're going to list a couple of the cards that were heavily hyped, and we're going to look back and see if these actually lived up to the expectations. And no card gets people more hyped than one that has either the word Mox or Lotus included as part of it. And Nyx Lotus, when it was first previewed, really was no exception to the hype train. Nyx Lotus is a 4-mana mana rock that taps for mana equal to your devotion to a color. Immediately, people were making comparisons to things like Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, a powerful mana engine that actually managed to get itself banned out of the Pioneer format. I think, though, I am the only person who is currently using Nyx Lotus in a deck, and it is probably one of the weaker mana rocks in the deck where I am running it. Alex, Jake, are either of you guys running the deck running Nyx Lotus in the deck currently or have seen it in the wild?
I am not currently. I do have a couple decks that have to go really deep on the questionably good mana rocks. But even so, I'm not running this mostly because it does cost four. That's a pretty big downside for a mana rock if you're using it to accelerate out some plays by the time you have four mana to dump into it, and it comes into play tapped. It's a mana rock that is not terribly fast.
It's currently sitting in a list I'm putting back together. It's one of the older decks I've had, and it's also in one of the colors I think can best abuse it. And it's a Muzio Visionary Architect deck, where in this case it's a bit higher side mana cost actually works out with Muzio, because it by itself, once I can actually untap with it, which there are tons of cards in both blue and artifacts that do, it'll get a hefty bit of being able to look into the deck with Muzio's ability and generate the mana that I need. So I think it'll probably fit better in Muzio and just blue artifact based decks than it would be in any other mono colored deck that can take advantage of it, mainly because of just how blue interacts with artifacts.
Well, the issue I see with Muzio is you're not going to be able to tap it for a lot of mana. You're not going to have a lot of pips on the battlefield in a Muzio deck.
So the way I've traditionally built Muzio is there are artifact creatures that it plays off as well. I'm not entirely sure how I want to take it, so to speak. It's definitely one of the weaker ones in there, but I'm not as hesitant to cut it as I would be yet. There's still a lot to that kind of pan out with that, but
yeah, it's in my Torbrand deck currently as the least good mana rock. Just having a commander that has three pips in it kind of made me want to try it. I've never really been impressed when I've drawn it with Torbrand. Let me put it this way. If they print another really good three-mana rock that really rewards you for playing one color, I will be there in a heartbeat over that. Next card on our list is another one that got a little bit of hype, and that is Eidolon of Obstruction. It is a 1 and a white for an enchantment creature. Spirit is a 2/1 with first strike, and loyalty abilities of planeswalkers your opponent's control cost 1 more to activate. So we got a card that interacts with planeswalker loyalty abilities.
Cool.
Yay.
We really need a cricket sound effect for this. I have not seen the card anywhere.
I've only seen it in Legacy Death and Taxes as a sideboard card against Liliana.
Yeah, but... yeah. This card really got a bunch of hype and a lot of people talking about it. It's interesting design space, but like a lot of the first time they delved into the design space, this one doesn't seem like it's going to be leaving a big impact on our format.
It's a pretty decent effect that can tax cards that nobody plays, so hooray.
I feel like a good... like, it may have been designed more specifically with like Brawl in mind, where planeswalkers can be commanders, maybe?
Or standard.
Yeah, I don't know.
We're trying to validate it in some space.
I think at the end of the day, this one was... A noble attempt that'll overall be a mess. Next
it's
one,
that 2/1 first striker.
Yeah, we saw better 10 years ago in terms of stat line. I mean, it's not terrible, but at the same time, this thing did not live up to the hype. Now, the next one that got a lot of hype, particularly in limited circles, was our Kiora Best the Sea God, 5/2 blue for a Saga enchantment for the first chapter, you get an 8/8 blue Kraken creature token with hexproof. Second chapter, tap all non-land permanents your opponents can target opponent controls. Those lands do not untap during the controller's next. Those non-land permanents do not untap during the controller's next untap step. And chapter three is gain control, target permanent opponent controls, untap it. So bat breaking and almost unbeatable in Theros Beyond Death Limited. Not particularly impressive in Commander for a 7-mana play.
When I was looking at rebuilding Banta Enchantress when Theros was first spoiled, I definitely thought to be like, what if there was a cool way to just constantly just keep reusing Enchantress or Sagas? It's like removing the counters and just constant, like I have them, they're constant value engines, and it just, there didn't seem to be an actual way for it to pan out without having to invest tons of mana to recast them or do some grand and crazy shenanigans to get there.
And then our next one on the list that got a lot of hype Maybe just for the meme factor of it, was the Nadir Kraken, one of the blue for a 2/3 creature Kraken. Whenever you draw a card, you may pay one generic mana. If you do, put a +1/+1 counter on Nadir Kraken and create a 1/1 blue tentacle creature token. And yes, they had tentacle tokens in packs. A lot of people got really excited about this. I've seen it in a handful of blue decks, but it doesn't seem like it is the big blue card draw payoff engine that a lot of people kind of were hoping it to be. Like, it's fine, but I don't know, just didn't live up to the hype.
Crickets.
I will find us a cricket sound effect for this. All right, our next card on our hype list was the Nightmare Shepherd. 2/2 black for an enchantment creature. Demon is a 4/4 with flying. Whenever another non-token creature you control dies, you may exile it. If you do, create a token that's a copy of that creature, except that it's a 1/1 and it's a nightmare in addition to its other types. I don't know. People were very excited about this, being able to throw it in every black deck and then get double the enter the battlefield triggers and build this massive army. And I don't know, I think people kind of underestimated how much they would prefer to just keep getting the creatures out of their graveyard.
Yeah, if that said whenever a creature dies and didn't have the exile clause in there, it would be absolutely busted. It's almost like a predecessor to Luminous Blood Moth from Ikoria. Except worse.
And then the last card that was on the list of extremely hyped, as any kind of card advantage in red is Storm Herald. 2 and a red for a creature human shaman, a 3/2 with haste. When Storm Herald enters the battlefield, return any number of aura cards from your graveyard to the battlefield attached to creatures you control. Exile those auras at the beginning of your next end step. If those auras would leave the battlefield, exile them instead of putting them anywhere else. Alex, you mentioned Naya as a potential build path for Enchantress.
Yeah, Naya with Yurl the Mistalker makes you want to focus more on the aura aspect as compared to just, you know, standard static artifacts or enchantments. So Storm Herald would be able to come down, say, late game, and if you had just a whole slew of crazy aura enchantments in your graveyard, you could come down and you could definitely alpha strike someone, you know, from clear from 40 life to zero with the right enchantments. The downside to that is it's very much kind of like a Hail Mary play, where no way of finagling with it can kind of cause you to keep those auras once Storm Herald does the deed. So it comes in, it brings them all back, and then that's it. That's, you've got one shot.
Yeah, it's really not the great red hope that people were kind of describing it as. Is this is it, this is the big red card advantage engine that we had all hoped for. Again, it's certainly cool design space, and I like that when we have a set focused on a particular card type, we get to see stuff like this, just playing around in different areas of the color pie. But outside, there's some really specific decks, and I mean, even in Yurl, you probably want that as just your last resort to get cards back onto Yurl if you weren't able to regrow them otherwise. So those were the most hyped cards. I'm now going to read us our list of our top 10 overall cards as of recording this episode on June 8th, 2020. And I want to react to this list and see what do we think of the cards that people are playing the most. So the top 10 cards, starting at number one as of EDH Rex data as of June 8th, we have Dryad of the Elysian Grove as number one, Thassa's Oracle at number two, Underworld Breach at number three, Nyx Bloom Ancient at number four, Heliod's Intervention at number five, Thassa Deep Dwelling at number six, Destiny Spinner at number seven, Shadow Spear at number eight, Calyx Destiny's Hand at number nine, and Athreos the Shroud Veiled at number 10. So let's react to this. Jake, what's your takeaway from this top 10 list of the most played overall cards in terms of the number of decks they're appearing in?
So just looking at the list overall, there's definitely a trend of value on here. Dryad of the Elysian Grove as the most popular card in the set does a common effect that a lot of decks enjoy putting out. It does both fixing and gives you extra land drops. Mm-hmm. And there's already cards that do both of those things. They're already run, so this gives you a little more redundancy in those decks.
Right.
It's kind of interesting seeing Thassa's Oracle so high on this list. Basically, it's just an upgraded Laboratory Maniac. So
how exactly is Thassa's Oracle upgraded over the traditional Lab Maniac?
So the wording on Laboratory Maniac is if you would draw a card when you have no cards in your library, you win the game. Thassa's Oracle has a lot more words on it, so I'll go ahead and read them. It's when Thassa's Oracle enters the battlefield, look at the top X cards of your library, where X is your devotion to blue. Put up to one of them on top of your library and the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. If X is greater than or equal to the number of cards in your library, you win the game. So if you have zero cards in your library and you cast Thassa's Oracle, you will win the game. It has a couple more strengths over Laboratory Maniac in that you don't need an outside source of draw. So that's one fewer cards that you need. Also, it is an enter the battlefield trigger. So even if Thassa's Oracle dies before the trigger resolves, it's still on the stack and it still has the potential to win you the game. Unlike Labman, where if he's out and you play a card draw spell and somebody kills him, all you're doing is losing the game.
Really powerful effect. It's been format defining in multiple formats. It is powerful in Pioneer. It is seeing play as a, I won't even say seeing play, I would say it is defining the current CDH metagame right now. Yeah, if you're playing in the optimized quadrant at all, you're probably going to be running into this card as part of some kind of a demonic consultation or tainted pact win con pretty regularly.
Yeah, it's pretty much pushed Laboratory Maniac completely out of the competitive format. And the War of the Spark Jace is starting to be a little more on the fringe just because that one. One point I did kind of want to bring up is that it is number two on this list. It's higher than some specific like Voltron cards and a lot of other very highly talked about and enjoyed cards, which I think is interesting because it might mean the overall shift in Commander is perhaps on an upward trend of power level.
I mean, her scrying off of Pips and Blue, though, is powerful in of itself, though. Like, she is value outside of being a game-winning engine.
Yeah, there's definitely a value piece to it, no doubt about it. I think the value overall pales in comparison to the just sheer power of her win-the-game effect. You know what? No matter what, she helped get Flash banned. So I'm here to praise our sushi overlords.
I guess on the absolute floor, Laboratory Maniac is a gray ogre, which is awful. And Thassa's Oracle is one mana cheaper and can block Temna. We got to get that reference in, I guess, at least once per episode.
We have to do that once per episode. That's our mandatory. And then, Jake, I think our number three card on the overall top 10 cards has also been making some waves in multiple formats and CDH.
Yeah, Underworld Breach is kind of a budget knockoff Yawgmoth's Will. If knockoff meant it is sometimes better than the original.
I mean, so it's banned in Legacy now. It's a mainstay in combo decks in Pioneer.
Yeah, it's one of those, another powerful recursion engine. Anything that lets you recast spells over and over has a lot of potential.
Very happy that I got mine for my Opus Thief deck for Extended Art goodness.
Yeah, it's kind of neat because it's an incredibly powerful card. Like you mentioned, it's already banned in Legacy. It's defining a lot of formats. And I'm looking at it right now, and it's $2.60. So that's
pretty awesome. Yeah, I really can't believe that. I've already put my non-foil extended art version into Torbrand just because it's a red deck. It could use all the card advantage it can get. And quite honestly, if I'm trying to jam that win, I don't care how much value I have to get rid of from the graveyard. I feel like Boros decks, red white, would also really like an effect like this to just be able to, sure, I'm not getting anything back out of my graveyard anyway. Let me just go all in and try to grind some value back out of it while I have a chance to do so. Yeah, this is criminally underpriced, and we are not a finance podcast, but this is the card that, you know, 1 year from now we turn around and look and say, when did this become $10?
Yeah, we were comparing it to Yawgmoth's Will, which is currently $90. So there's a bit of disparity there.
Alex, is there anything else on the list of our top 10 cards that really stands out to you, apart from that overall trend of value that we're seeing?
I've enjoyed, I like Druid of the Elysium Grove being a bit higher up on the list, and just to kind of appreciate it, it's just a wide spectrum of things. So there's definitely value there, like we've touched on, being able to tap mana for any color and being able to play extra lands. The value trend is something that I, as a player, tend to lean towards. Destiny Spinner is another one that I'm happy is on the list. I'm surprised it's not higher because of just its ability, you know, being a 2/3 for two, and your artifact or your enchantments and your creatures are uncountable. It's an incredibly powerful effect. And I know for being as obscure and as low to the ground that it kind of is, it's actually found its way into a lot of the competitive and casual EDH decks as a way to kind of protect your creatures when they kind of come in. Protect those casts, get those good creatures down, things of that nature. So I definitely enjoy seeing that on there. Taking a different spin on a bit, Kallax, seeing him on the list at all is a little surprising.
Yeah, I was shocked to see him this high as well. I mean, I know people are always hungry for their Enchantress decks, but I bought my Serra's Sanctum. I went out and I did that. And I still look sideways at Kallax and say, I don't know, man.
And all I can think of is they use his ability to attach removal to their enchantments and then just count on the plethora of abilities out there that make enchantments, you know, Shroud or Hexproof or Indestructible.
Right,
and just hope
that
they can use Kallax as a, you know, repetitive form of individual spot removal. And
yeah, I'm still surprised to see him that high on the list, in all honesty.
And then we have Nyx Bloom Mansion also on there is something I'm enjoying just because giant mana ramping stompy stomp elemental is pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's one that I think lived up to the hype. I don't think it's going to be in that discussion of is it Paradox Engine good, but it is certainly good. Yeah, there are a handful of busted scenarios for it with like reanimator decks, but I don't know. I've got it in my Slimefoot Mana Sinks deck. It is kind of a balanced value style deck where its whole goal is just going over the top in late game with unreasonable amounts of mana production that I then sink into Slimefoot or other sinks to then turn into Sapperlings, which then turn into a win condition.
I think out of all the cards I've seen on here, I think it's the only one where it didn't pretend to be something else. It's just we knew exactly what this thing was going to be when it was spoiled.
Yeah, exactly. And then for our number 8 on the list, Shadow Spear, definitely has made an impact. It's found way into my build of Greven. Jake, is that in your build of Greven currently?
Yes. Turns out a deck that kills itself as fast as it kills the other opponents likes to give lifelink to a giant beater.
Especially on a 1-mana equipment that only costs 2 to equip.
And yeah, it's a combination of lifelink and evasion through the trample. Makes it pretty helpful.
Yeah, and then honestly, just that incidental get around hexproof indestructible in a black and red deck, and honestly in a lot of decks, it's just incidentally good. This one is probably just going to be an all-star in Voltron decks that are leaning on equipment at all until the end of time. This one is another one that lived up to the hype, I think.
I think it falls in the same category of equipment that Sword of the Animus does. Like, it's one of those cards where it has it's aggressively costed, it has a unique enough effect, it's either not unique, but desired enough effect to where it can be slotted in some areas where you normally wouldn't expect to see it. So, like, Greven has it running in there. I'm running it in Edgar Markov, and I equate the two in terms of, do I have a slot that I can kind of be a flex slot? I think Shadow Spear would fit here.
That's a really good comparison with Sword of the Animus. I really like that comparison. And then of all the interventions, having Heliod's intervention as the one that makes the list, which is able to hit artifacts and enchantments at instant speed, can remove multiple targets with a single card. I mean, this is basically the way Mono White gets its card advantage, by killing more things than it takes to destroy them. All the way back to good old Wrath of God. Instant speed, destroying artifacts and enchantments, targeted removal, scales to the game. Yeah, I'm not surprised to see this on the list. I think it's a good card.
It's Meltdown with one additional white pip, right? Just two white X, destroy a bunch of artifacts, or gain a bunch of life.
Yeah, the only downside to Meltdown always was that it could hit your own things, and if you're in red, you're probably not going to be too happy losing your rocks, which is the only thing that's really stopped me from jamming into almost all of my red decks. Being targeted and being able to select what you remove, yeah, Heliod's Intervention is pretty good. Pleased to see that on here. So those are the top cards from the set. Some of them are surprises, some of them are not surprises. Some of the hype that we heard as the set was coming out didn't quite make it there, and some of them, in the case of Nyx Bloom Ancient or Shadow Spear, absolutely did. Some of the cards made big impacts in a lot of different formats, some of them just in different quadrants of Commander. But there are some JIT cards that flew under the radar, and this set has also unearthed some other hidden gems from further back in Magic's history. I'm going to get us started with a card that is flying under the radar a little bit, and is one that I've actually just this weekend added into my Karlov Luris deck, and that would be Birth of Melitus. It is one of the sagas. One in a white for an enchantment saga. Chapter one is search a library for a basic planes card, reveal it, put it into your hand, then shuffle your library. Chapter two is create a 0/4 colorless wall artifact creature token with Defender. And chapter three is you gain two life. Cards like Tithe and Gift of Estates can get you multiple planes, and they can do it kind of at the same speed that the Birth of Melitus can. Birth of Melitus only gets you one planes card, but it's still a way to keep up with land drops in white. There's not a condition to get the planes card. Your opponents don't have to control more lands than you, as is often the case with white pseudo ramp. Yeah, in the Luris type deck, where I'm looking for permanents that are going to get me some type of advantage for 2 CMC or less, this edged out Wayfarer's Bauble in the deck. In that particular deck, I'm also happy to have another creature entering the battlefield and having another life gain trigger off of Soul Sisters, and then at Chapter 3, having another life gain effect with it. I think most decks probably care about the first effect the most, and then the second effect just a little bit, and probably don't care about the third effect at all. But this was a nice little uncommon, and nice to see more ways for white to get a little bit of love. What other cards, as you were looking through the set, what else did you find, I guess, maybe even further back in the history of Magic?
So I did not find this one personally. Someone else did. But Brain Freeze. It's a well-known Storm card from Scourge, a blue instant for one generic and one blue. Target player puts the top three cards of his or her library into his or her graveyard. And Storm. So this has pretty sweet interactions with Underworld Breach. Conveniently, Underworld Breach gives everything escape with a cost of exiling three cards from your graveyard. So you can actually target yourself with Brain Freeze to fuel your Underworld Breach, to cast a Brain Freeze, to fuel your Underworld Breach. And at that point, you can start playing other cards out of your graveyard, because each cast is storming, so you're going from 3 to 6 to 9, etc. You can use Lion's Eye Diamond to continue to pay for your Brain Freeze out of your graveyard, and then eventually you'll have a pretty hefty storm count, and then you can just mill people to death in Commander, which is ridiculous.
Mill is a popular strategy.
It's nice because it doubles as both a win con and milling other people to death, and also, I mean, you're playing Underworld Breach, so dumping your library into your graveyard basically means you have a, you know, 50-card hand, and you can usually do pretty good stuff with that many cards.
Generally speaking, that is the case. Alex, what about you? What other hidden gems have you unearthed for us?
And my hidden gem is one that's kind of been near and dear to me as I've tried to play it over the years. It's Bind. It is a 2-mana instant from Invasion. It is 1 and a green. And I know it's going to sound really weird, but it says counter target activated ability and draw a card, which are distinctive blue phrasing, but on a green card. And there were cards that kind of made me lean into that vein, was our our near and dear Eidolon of Obstruction with its ability to tax activate ability of walkers. And Bind has served me well, where one of my favorite things to do is I'd watch someone try and ultimate a planeswalker, and then I would just kind of bind that, or activate abilities, fetch lands, make people sad. And it's just, it's unique because it just, it sneaks under the radar because you don't really expect that effect from green. And it has a fun way of interacting with all of the activate abilities of the gods. So it stops the Heliod Sunground from, you know, giving something lifelink at the last moment. Or if someone, you know, goes to try and sneak something with Purphoros, it can stop that. So it kind of just made me think back to that vein of activate abilities in a unique color.
Who knew green could be so sneaky? I'm going to throw out one last bonus hidden gem for anyone who is working on their Enchantress decks. Most Enchantress decks wind up basing themselves in green. And there is a wonderful old card from Tempest called Broken Fall. So Broken Fall is an enchantment for 2 and a green. Its ability reads, return Broken Fall to its owner's hand, regenerate target creature. So you may be thinking, what the heck does this even do? So on the front end, you pay 2 and a green, and you get your Enchantress triggers. You draw your cards. If you have something like Eutropa the Twice Favored, you get something +1/+1 and flying to end of turn. If you have some other payoffs, great, you get those payoffs. And then you can just do it again. So the way that Regenerate works is it puts basically a shield on a creature where the next time it would be destroyed or die or take lethal damage. Instead, you tap it, remove it from combat, and you erase the lethal effects from it. And the creature is back to normal and healthy. So you can use this as a reusable source of card advantage in an Enchantress deck. You can easily use it to also protect your commander, protect your Enchantresses, and then each time you do it, you get your repeated card draw or other Enchantress triggers off of it. Importantly, you do not need to wait for your commander or other card to be regenerated. You can put a regeneration shield on another card with Broken Fall, return to your hand, and if you have enough mana, you can just play it multiple times in a turn. You can put multiple regeneration shields on that creature. You don't need to wait for it to be threatened. You can use it proactively and just use it as a value engine. It is a little old card, but one that I found a lot of when sorting my Tempest bulk years and years ago. There are just some fun old cards in the history of Magic. But I think that brings us to the end of our cast tonight. We hope you enjoyed our set retrospective on Theros Beyond Death. Next time, we're going to be talking about something that is near and dear to Alex's heart. It starts with a T.
And ends with eyeballs.
That's right. Next time, we are talking about Tribal. So until then, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
I am Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG, or you can send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.